This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. From Afghanistan to the White House this fall and winter, we've heard a lot about God and evil and paradise and hell. Tonight, we're stepping back to look straight at the spiritual issues behind the sound and fury of 9/11 and its aftermath. We're talking frankly about love, hate, faith, belief, and the search of all souls for hope and meaning. First, new information ties Richard Reed, the man who allegedly tried to blow up a plane by detonating explosives in his sneakers, to a London mosque. Clarence Mitchell is following the story for the BBC. I asked him for the latest developments.
A picture is now emerging here in London. A little bit more detail is coming out. Richard Reed, as he was called, appears to have been a worshipper at a mosque in Brixton in South London for several years, where he went under the name of Abdul Rahim. He's a petty criminal with a string of convictions for street crime, including muggings, and it's thought that he served time in several prisons in England, including the Feltham Young Offenders Institute in West London, and it's thought he converted to Islam whilst he was in custody.
But he went from petty crime to being prepared to be a suicide terrorist with bombs in his shoes. How did the transformation take place?
That is what we are all trying to establish at the moment. It seems that over a period of years, he underwent some sort of radicalization, what you would describe as a fairly normal, happy-go-lucky young man, even though he did have this criminal aspect to his background. He went to study Arabic classes there, and in time, he began to challenge the teachings of the mosque leaders themselves. He became more arrogant, they say, and then he gave up wearing Western clothing and, in fact, began turning up in military gear, army jackets, things like that. And as I say, he appears to have undergone a radicalization assumed by the leaders at the mosque that he came into contact with other more extreme fundamentalists somewhere within the London area, and that they have turned him against the teachings of the mosque, which the mosque leaders themselves say are peaceful in their intent.
We've seen a picture of the mosque. It's just a brick Georgian structure in Brixton there in South London, and the head of the mosque, Abdul Haq Baker, has been speaking out against this kind of extremism, but even he warns that there may be 100 more, in his estimation, potential suicide bombers in the wings in London. Is there some kind of split in the Islamic community within London between mainstream and fundamentalist, and it plays out even within one mosque?
It's difficult to tell. It may well be that there are these fundamentalists. They do exist, of course. He is saying, quite rightly, as you say, that the many other Muslim youths here in England are in danger of falling prey to these extremists, but by their nature, they are necessarily will be underground and very low profile. It is difficult to assess the scale of the problem, but clearly a problem there is. And Abdul Haq Baker, as you say, says that Reed himself was not capable of mounting an exercise such as this. They see him really as, if you like, the fall guy that was, in Baker's words, some sort of experiment for the terrorists who were leading him into this idea of a jihad, a holy war that he wanted to fulfill. And he believes, the chairman of the Brixton Mosque believes, that this was a test run, as he put it, and that if the American Airlines flight had exploded, the terrorists would have drawn lessons from that this was another successful way of them achieving their awful aims.
Clarence Mitchell, have you seen in the response from the British Islamic community, what can you tell from that response about their view of Richard Reed and this radical violent fringe of the Islamic community there? Is it being condemned, or how is it being discussed?
Almost to a man, the leaders of the Muslim community do condemn this sort of activity, this sort of radical fundamentalism. We saw that very quickly after September the 11th. A few Muslim youths came onto the streets in certain parts of Britain. Luton is one area just north of London where they came out to support what had happened on September the 11th and to say that this was a blow for Islam. And those youths themselves were very quickly slapped down by their own leadership. There was a great sense of shock and horror at what happened on September the 11th, and leaders here in London are again saying that Richard Reed was very much a loner, and that those extremists that he apparently was in touch with and who turned him into the character that he apparently has become, they too should be condemned. They say that the teachings of the mosque, the teachings of Islam, is one of tolerance, of one of a religion that accepts other faiths and that their right to coexist within the world.
And yet here was Richard Reed with two shoes rather skillfully packed with plastic explosives. What's the availability of plastic explosives in the UK?
Well, it is not easily available. It is not something you can simply pick up. And that's what Abdulhak Baker is saying, that Richard Reid simply wasn't capable of mounting this operation by himself. They say that, to get hold of that sort of explosive would have involved contacts, perhaps in the underworld. It is not simply available, and that therefore he must have been put up to this. He must have been carrying out this from people behind him with that expertise, with that access to that sort of equipment and explosives. Therefore, they point to the extremists. It has to be said as well that there is a potential link with the events of September the 11th. Zacharias Moussaoui, the Frenchman of Moroccan origin, who also lived in Brixton, who is currently being detained in America in connection with the September 11th attacks, he too at one point was a worshipper at the same mosque as Reid. Now, whether the two men knew each other or were connected, we cannot say for sure.
The flight, American Airlines Flight 63, was headed from Paris to Miami. We read that Richard Reid was reportedly prevented from boarding a similar flight in Paris the day before because he was acting suspiciously. We're told in the States that European air security is greater than ours here, but can he have been just turned away from one flight to be free only to show up for the next and without any record of the earlier suspicions?
Again, there seems to have been some fundamental failing of the security at the airport in Paris. Yes, you're quite right. Security over here is as intense, if not tighter, than that in the US now. We are, of course, well used to terrorism here in Britain and in other areas of Europe. So, yes, the security procedures are in place, but almost incredibly, it seems that he was acting suspiciously. The authorities in Paris did detain him. They questioned him at length. They looked into his passport, which it now seems was genuine. There were question marks over whether it was a stolen British passport or a forged British passport, but it appears to have been genuinely issued for him. But by the time they'd finished questioning him, they were prepared to allow him to board the flight the previous night, but he had missed it simply because of the time. So the next day he returned to the airport without any obvious luggage, again for a transatlantic flight. That in itself would raise huge questions. But the Paris authorities said there was basically no reason why they shouldn't let him on board. He wasn't wanted for any particular offences or in connection with anything else. And so he was allowed on board. But you're right, on the face of it, it seems an astonishing failing of the security procedures.
Clarence Mitchell is a reporter for the BBC. He spoke to us from London. Malice and murder on the scale of September 11th are enough to rock anyone's soul. And the contest of claims on God's favor since the 11th is a lot for any believer or non-believer to ponder. Tonight, we're stepping back for some soul talk. To help us through it, we've tracked down my own childhood minister, the Reverend Richard G. Watts. As a boy, I knew him as a man who marched for civil rights and preached a powerful message of human compassion. With John Dominic Crossan, he co-authored a challenging book on the historical Jesus entitled Who is Jesus? He's retired now, but I still think of him as my rabbi, my imam, a mentor. So join me tonight and let's put some hard questions to Richard Watts. Was 9/11 part of God's plan? Does God even have a plan? And how do we square devout belief in religion with coexistence on this crowded little planet? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Atlanta is Reverend Richard Watts. Good evening, Dick Watts.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to hear your voice.
It's a long time since
long time.
We shared a college town in the Illinois Corn Belt. And I guess I knew you as a liberal Presbyterian doing civil rights during the civil rights struggles and the Vietnam War. And we have a whole new crisis on our hands now. And I thank you for your taking the time to come on with us tonight.
I'm glad to be with you, Tom.
Dick Watts, I guess right off the bat, I wonder how you're thinking about religion. You've spent a lifetime in it, and yet this awful season, we've seen it used to justify terrible killing. It's done a lot of good, and it's been used many times as a wrapper for violence. On balance, how does religion stack up as a net positive or something else?
Well, I think that what you say is absolutely true, and one of the biggest mistakes we can make is simply to think that religion is in and of itself a good thing. It may be a good thing, it may not be a good thing. And obviously, human history is full of acts of self-sacrifice and healing and heroism and openness and tolerance on the part of religious people. And it's also full of crusades and intolerance, exclusivism on the part of others in the name of their religion. So obviously we've got some sifting and sorting to do, and we need to ask some really basic questions about what is it that makes religion turn in one way or another.
Well, how are you grappling with those questions this season, Dick? What's foremost on your mind?
Well, one of the things on my mind is I don't think that you can divide humanity's religious life, good and bad, into this religion in the good column and that religion in the bad. I think it crosses all of the faiths. And in a certain sense, I really believe that in the world there are probably only two religious types. They are open and they're closed. Mm. Those that are open tend to be pluralistic. They're willing to say, I see what I see, but let's talk about what you see. Those that are closed say, I have a direct pipeline to the Almighty. I know what the Almighty's will is, and you either agree with me or you're somewhere in the outer darkness.
Open and closed. So in those terms, Dick Watts, how do you think the U.S. religious community is holding up in this season, and how about Islam?
Well, let's take Islam first. I think it would be a huge mistake for us to type Islam with the fundamentalist terrorists who have bloodied our nation. That clearly is a minority movement. There clearly is great diversity within Islam, and I take the view that right now, one of the creative things I think that's coming out of this moment is an internal discussion that Islam needs to have within itself, and I see that moderate voices now have a chance to say, wait a minute, you have you who are terrorists have bloodied us too, because you've given a false image of what Islam is. So I see this as potentially hopeful. In terms of the Christian world in our country, I've been heartened by the fact that the churches, I'm thinking right at the moment of the Catholic bishops, I'm thinking of the Pope, mm-hmm. have spoken not in terms at all of revenge, but in terms of justice, in terms of limiting violence, in terms of reconstruction that must happen after the violence. And I think that's out of the authentic side of the Christian faith.
Dick, I'm struck in this Christmas season where all the stories are about a poor and dispossessed Jewish child born in the Palestine or the Galilee, facing a world-straddling empire, and,
right.
and the struggle ultimately evidenced in the Christian teaching to deal with that. And now here today, the United States sees itself as the wounded party since September 11th, but
right.
but we're not the dispossessed. We're not the poor. We are the world-straddling power. It's a strange twist to get one's mind around in considering the events of this fall.
It is a strange twist because really you see a Jesus who is trying to figure out how to stand against the unjust power that others possess, and our question is how to use justly the power that we possess. So we are in a very different social setting than Jesus, and perhaps it's good for us to know that and to remind ourselves that you can't really draw straight lines from the biblical world to our world where our situation may be very, very different.
And yet, that's the power that we are. In religious terms, how have you felt about the United States' response to September 11th?
Well, you remember in the very beginning, Tom, that our military effort was called Operation Infinite Justice.
For a day or two.
For a day or two, exactly. And because there was a religious revolt against that terminology, not only from Muslims, but also from Christian leaders who said, wait a minute, infinite justice belongs to God alone, and our quest for justice is something less than infinite, so let's be a little more humble about what our aims are here. And I think that was a very helpful turn.
Reverend Richard G. Watts, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about spirituality, religious faith in the wake of 9/11 in the holiday season. What issues of the spirit are you wrestling with? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the life of faith, about religion and spirituality in this trying and difficult season. Our guest is Reverend retired Richard G. Watts. He was a Presbyterian minister and later pastor of the New Covenant Community Church in Normal, Illinois. He's co-author of Who is Jesus? Answers to Your Questions About the Historical Jesus. He was my own childhood mentor, and he's been good enough to come on tonight to answer questions from this microphone and from you. Join us. How's your faith in man, in woman, in God holding up this season? Are you feeling more religious, less religious, or anti-religious? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dick Watts, let's go right to some of the tough stuff in the Christian section of the Bible. Turn the other cheek and judge not, lest ye be judged. We all watch those towers come down, and right, it's hard to fit turn the other cheek into that image. How does that work out in Christian theology?
Well, it is. And, you know, this was the point that we were talking about earlier, that it's hard to draw straight lines from the biblical world to ours. Take, for example, that idea of turning the other cheek. My understanding is this, that if you're slapped, Jesus says, on the left cheek, turn to him the other also. Now, how do you slap somebody on the left cheek? Well, it's a backhand slap. It's not, you're not using your right fist. What does it mean? It means it's the slap that a superior gives to an inferior, that a Roman soldier gives to a peasant, that a lord gives to a serf. So what is going on here? Well, I'm kind of reminded of the movie about Gandhi. You may remember this wonderful scene where Indians are moving up. They know they're about to be beat one after another by British soldiers, but they keep coming, and they keep coming, and they keep coming, and a reporter races over to a telephone and calls London, and he says, India is free. Because in their refusal to be cowed, to be submissive, in their nonviolent resistance, they had said, you cannot make serfs out of us. You cannot make slaves out of us. I think that's very close to what was going on in Jesus' life and ministry.
Those were colonial subjects turning the other cheek. How does a superpower do it?
Yeah, well, that's an important question to ask. And my answer would be, all right, you always have to seek justice, and seeking the perpetrators of this evil is seeking justice. Then the question is, what are you going to do to try to reconcile enemies? What are you going to try to do to heal the hurts? What are you going to try to do to recreate community? I don't think that turning the other cheek means that you ignore evil or you don't try to create justice. But what it does mean is that you're always looking for a way to get reconciled.
And it also, these circumstances also bring up, Dick Watts, the teachings about the rich and the powerful, that the poor will inherit the earth, that the rich and powerful, it's easier for the camel to get through the eye of a needle than for them to get into heaven. We are reminded again and again in the United States of our superpower status this fall. It's the offended superpower that the whole world is watching. What are the religious dimensions in those terms of being an overwhelming force and trying to respond to a grievous wound?
Well, this is a place where I think we need a powerful act of imagination. On the one hand, we have to say clearly, there is no excuse or justification for the act of the terrorists on 9/11. That's clear, and they must be sought and brought to justice. What is also clear is that as this superpower you have described, we need to try to see ourselves through the eyes of much of the rest of the world, which is dispossessed and which is not poor. One of the questions Americans have been raising, and it's a good question, is why do they hate us so? That question needs to be raised not only about terrorists, but also about the many, many more people who listen at least to the message of the terrorists because they also feel dispossessed and in some way aggrieved by our country. So the question is, can we also be self-critical? Can we see ourselves as others see us? Can we know that in the world we have not always been the innocent party? That whether you talk about Guatemala or Chile or Afghanistan or Iran or Zaire, that there is a history of our involvements that is less than noble. So that those in the World Trade Towers were indeed the innocents. But as a nation on the world stage, we have not always been innocent, and we need to listen. You know, I guess it was E. Stanley Jones, the famous Methodist minister missionary, who said one time, "My critics are the unpaid watchmen of my soul." And I think we need to listen also to our critics.
We're talking with retired Reverend Richard G. Watts tonight. You can join the conversation. Our subject is religion and faith, spirituality in this very hard season. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Stephen is on the line. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Dick.
Hi.
One of the issues that I think that we need to consider, despite the fact that there are individuals who are open or closed, the reality is that either Jesus was the Son of God brought to earth to redeem people's souls, or he wasn't, and either the Quran was revealed to people by Allah as a literal word of God, or it wasn't. Ultimately, the different traditions are irreconcilable. They teach things which are not compatible, and as open as individuals might be, you can't change those things, and I think that that causes some of the conflict.
Stephen, are you saying that you are a follower of one of these faiths and it makes you unable to accept the other?
No, I was raised Jewish, but I don't think that's not the key here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Dick Watts, what about the point? We've heard a lot about absolutes this fall. It's been particularly from Osama bin Laden, who many Muslims would not choose as their religious spokesman, but yet he's right out front in putting Islam out there. But Stephen says, well, all these religions are the sort of received wisdom. They deal in absolutes. How do we reconcile one to the other?
Well, there's a lot of truth in what Stephen says, because every religion has in some way its trump card that it plays against other faiths. I think we need, whatever faith community we come from, a healthy dose of humility. The truth of the matter is, I think, that if I had been born in Saudi Arabia, I would have worked out my religious destiny as a Muslim. Had I been born in India, I probably would have worked out my religious destiny as a Hindu. Now, does that mean that what I understand as a Christian is invalid? No. It simply means that what we see depends on where we stand when we look. And I think that's an elemental act of humility that all of us need to know, that we only see what we have been enabled to see by our own culture and heritage. The second thing that I'd say about that is that I think we misunderstand the language of religion. The language of religion is a language of devotion. And, you know, sometimes somebody will say to his wife, you are the most wonderful wife in the world. He probably hasn't polled every wife in the world or every husband in the world. It's an expression of a relationship that goes very deep. It's an expression of gratitude. I think often religious language is like that, so that the love that I have for Jesus Christ is a way of saying, oh, thank you, I'm very grateful for what I've learned through the Hebrew prophets, what I've learned through Jesus. But in saying that, I don't deny for a moment that God may have reached other people through other voices and other experiences. I don't see why gratitude for one's understanding, one's tradition, needs to close him off from the possibility that others have also received grace in theirs.
And yet, Dick Watts, we see in the United States evangelical churches growing more quickly than old-line, mainline denominations. We see in the Islamic world fundamentalism also flow tide here. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm not persuaded in the first place that that's the case. I'm not at all persuaded that fundamentalism is – lapping up at all of the shores of the Islamic world.
In spite of the images on television.
And, you know, some moderate Muslim leaders have been very frustrated, feeling that since 9/11, their message isn't getting out and they're not being paid much attention to. Well, I can't judge that. But I don't believe that the future belongs to fundamentalisms of any stripe. And it's important to see that violence on the part of a small number of fundamentalists has crossed all of these lines. We have fundamentalist Christians who have attacked clinics in this country. Mm-hmm. We have a fundamentalist Jew who assassinated Rabin. And now we have some fundamentalist Muslims. So fundamentalism that turns to violence is a problem that each of these great faiths has to deal with internally. But I'm not ready to say that it represents the majority in any of them.
We're talking about the spirit life, the life of the soul, and religion tonight with Reverend Richard G. Watts. How should religions coexist on this crowded planet? And as the bracelets famously asked not long ago, what would Jesus do, or Muhammad, or Moses, or the Buddha? What are your spiritual questions tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. A lot of people want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was interested to find out that the Pope had said in the last couple of days, and I'll just note that he's not my chosen religious leader, but he said that he spoke to those who hunger for justice and peace, or those who accept the message of Christmas, that leaders of violence and war on any side not cloak their message in a message of God. And I think it's an interesting time to take a look at the way our president, for example, uses religious language, refers to God, refers to religion and Christianity, even initially called the United States War a crusade and rapidly retracted that, as he well should have. Mm-hmm. But I think it's even more interesting, and I would ask Reverend Watts a question about a different kind of fundamentalism and extremism, other than strictly religious, but another kind of fundamentalism that has gripped this country and
that
the
being?
World and led us to the disparity of wealth that we suffer, which is the root cause behind the discontent that leads to massive inequality and ultimately desperate attacks and terrorism.
John, you're packing a lot in there. Let us turn it over to Dick Watts. Thank you very much for your call, John. Dick, right off the bat, about the president's references to God in his very first big speech, his essentially saying God is on our side, and of course the tradition now of American presidents to always close with God bless America. How have you felt about George W. Bush's use of God in his way of addressing the crisis this fall?
Well, your caller mentioned that the president, in the very first instance, spoke of a crusade and very quickly retracted that, just as the Pentagon retracted the idea of infinite justice. Mm-hmm. That was a very appropriate retraction because it had such unfortunate centuries-old connotations in the Muslim world of warfare between Christians and Muslims. I'm willing to give the president credit for being, like the rest of us, on a very high learning curve. And I take comfort from the fact that misstatements like those have been retracted. I'm fully in accord with what your caller suggests, that at all costs, even when fighting against a clear act of aggression, we need to avoid triumphalism and self-righteousness or the identification of all of our purposes with those of God. I think it was Abraham Lincoln in the heart of the Civil War who said that he wasn't so much concerned with whether God was on his side as whether he was on God's. And I think Abraham Lincoln was one of our fine horseback theologians, if you will. So, and also the other point that your caller made is extremely important. While nothing justifies terrorist attacks, we do need to look behind them at the conditions that perhaps create terrorists, and rampant and growing economic inequality is certainly one of them. I think, moreover, in our own country, we have questions to ask about our economic ideologies. When, for example, after 9/11, Congress was in a great hurry to bail out corporations, but was very slow to deal with literally 100,000 individuals who lost their jobs in terms of providing health benefits or unemployment insurance. So we have our own issues with economic disparity that we need to address. And the corporate lobbyists have had a field day since 9/11, clothing all of their appeals in Washington in the anti-terrorist rhetoric. I don't think we need much more of that.
Martha's on the line. Welcome, Martha. You're on the air with Dick Watts.
Hi. I think it's wonderful to have this program. This is really something exceptional, I think, right now. And I do recall that during his campaign, our president spoke so much about how Jesus was in his heart and mm-hmm. changed his whole life. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, the season of the Prince of Peace. Mm. We're hoping for that. And yet, and he said also that we must not be arrogant, but we must show compassion and be humble. Well, that whole, I think that whole concept has gone down the drain.
How so, Martha? How so?
Well, he's talking, instead of talking about what have we done wrong, why do they hate us so much, which has been discussed some on this program, he's going ahead and talking about getting terrorists, we're bombing them, we bombed and bombed and bombed, we bombed many civilians, and he's ignoring this situation such as that Palestine, which has been suffering for a long time, and especially a half million children under the age of five have died in Iraq because of the sanctions. That's not touched upon at all.
But Martha, don't we have to do something about that imminent threat, even religious people, of terrorism?
Oh, I'm very frightened of terrorism, but I think that they can never find all the terrorists because the president has said himself that they are existing in 68 countries and in our own country. Mm-hmm. And I think to find a few people like that is far different from finding a country that has been terrible toward us, which we can conquer. Mm. But I think we have gone around the world too much. I don't think we can be bombing all the countries where he suspects there are terrorists. Mm.
Martha, thanks for your call. Let's put it to we've got it. Let's put it to Dick Watts. Dick, what about the balance between military response, a kind of strong-arm search for justice, and the moral response?
Well, I don't have any doubt at all about the need to ferret out and bring to justice the perpetrators of the terrorist act. And nor do I think many have any doubt about that. The question, you know, in Christian history, there's been a lot of talk about what can make a war just. And besides a just cause, mm-hmm. there needs to be a just means used, proportionality, an effort to protect non-combatants, an attempt to bring more good out of the conflict than would be caused by the destruction in the conflict. All of these raise very important questions that I think we should insist that lawmakers take into account. For example, our smart bombs are not always as smart as we would like to think they are, and innocents suffer and lands being bombed as well as innocents suffered in New York City. And so these questions of proportionality are always appropriate and need continually to be raised.
Dick Watts, we have to take a quick break. We're talking about the life of the Spirit, about religion tonight. What are your spiritual questions the day after Christmas, not long after Hanukkah, not long after Ramadan? From whatever angle you've got them, bring them on. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about religion and the life of the Spirit tonight with Reverend Richard G. Watts, co-author of Who is Jesus? Answers to Your Questions About the Historical Jesus. What issues of the Spirit are you wrestling with this season? Are you feeling more religious, less religious, or anti-religious? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Dave is on the line. Welcome, Dave. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for letting me call.
Good to have you.
You know, the question I had or the comment I had is I think we're always risking, if you will, being almost apologetic or, you know, that mm-hmm. phrase that's being talked about so often, almost self-hatred of strength, mm-hmm. and that we need to look at what made people so angry that they would attack civilians and in effect strap them to missiles and blow up buildings. I mean, there is no justification, and I don't think we have to do much self-analysis. because there is no way any religion would ever justify that kind of response, regardless of action.
We got it, Dave. Let's put it to Dick Watts. What about it, Dick? No need to apologize. The action was so heinous that our strong response is entirely justified.
I agree absolutely that there is no way and no need to justify the evil act. It is also, at the same time, necessary to understand the way the rest of the world sees us and the way the exercise of our power is seen. Power in itself, and I agree with your caller, power in itself is not a negative. The use of our power around the world is an important question that we need to look at, not only from the view of our self-interest, but also from the view of the needs of people around the world and other countries that our actions affect. And I think all that people are asking for, and I'm happy to say there are many voices asking for it, is that we have that element of self-criticism as we look around the world and not just assume that all that we do is innocent and blessed.
Adolf is on the line. Welcome, Adolf. You're on the air.
Hi, my name is Kedar.
Sorry, Kedar. Apologies. Good to have you.
I'm from India, and I just heard a reference to Mahatma Gandhi, who led the Indian freedom struggle. Now, my question is, how could the Gandhian principles of nonviolence be applicable in the present context and especially to India?
In India's conflict with Pakistan in particular, Kedar?
Yes.
Oh, Dick Watts, you're being asked to step into geopolitics here, but it's an interesting question at two levels. First of all, do you see a way to apply Gandhi's nonviolent principles in the conflict that the U.S. is in the midst of? And then an Indian is asking you about India.
The question about India is one that I'll pass on because he's asking about something about which I am not sufficiently knowledgeable to feel comfortable speaking.
Fair enough.
The question about principles is tougher, and it's something that I've wrestled with, and I know that many others have wrestled with in this situation. I must confess that it's extremely difficult for me to see that we could have made, as a nation, a Gandhian response to the attack on the World Trade Centers. Bin Laden declared war on the United States, or what he called the Jews and the Crusaders, over 3 years ago. And that declaration of war said that to kill Americans, both civil and military, is the duty of every Muslim who's able in any country where it's possible. How a Gandhian response to that would have helped and done anything other than exacerbate the situation, I confess that I cannot see.
Kedar, thanks for your call. Dick, where in Christian history was the turn made between the kind of disempowered minority fledgling religion and the powerful religion that had to deal with wielding power?
Well, there's absolutely no question that for the first three centuries of the Christian church, the church was pacifist in its responses. And then it became the power in the Roman Empire. And as you know, in the time of Constantine, from being a persecuted minority became the state religion. Consequently, questions needed to be asked about the relation of the state to violence, whereas formerly the questions had been simply of the individual Christian to violence. And it's in that context that the rules of just war began to be promulgated.
Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Sure. Actually, my question is kind of a good follow-up to that. I was just sort of struck by, after September 11th happened, the sort of calls for sacrifice that, you know, the president was issuing, and that there's a certain parallel between that and sort of, you know, Christians call for sacrifice of their own, so that in some ways belief in your state, in patriotism, becomes a religion in and of itself.
You're saying that patriotism and religion are comparable, are the same thing?
More or less. That, you know, if you look at the sort of the function that a religion serves for society, of being able to sort of ask individuals to look beyond themselves and give and sacrifice certain things like their labor, their time, their money, or their lives, like of the society, that, you know, a patriotic feeling or belief in your state sort of accomplishes similar things. that you give of yourself as a duty to your state as opposed to your religion.
Let's stay on, Chris. Let me put that to Dick Watts. Dick, do you buy that patriotism and religion are interchangeable?
No.
Chris?
Yes. Well, I mean,
that's a simple answer to a hypothesis there. But aren't one is about things
and the sort of high and the search for a higher life. But it seems to me that that people at their base level sort of look at that as a similar means of building a community. And I know they're not the same things, but they fulfill something for an individual as a similar thing.
Chris, let's get Dick Watts' response. Thanks for your call. Dick?
Sure. The reason that I say that they're not the same thing is that what at least the Christian faith teaches is that there is no human institution, there is no human idea, there's no human party, and there's no human nation that is absolute or can claim absolute loyalty, which belongs only to God. And therefore, every Christian lives in a certain degree of tension with every state, affirming it where it's possible, where it does justice, and being critical of it where it falls short of the standards of what Jesus called the kingdom. That is, the world as it would be if God were in direct charge rather than the Caesars and the Herods of the world. So I think the appropriate response of religious people is always that critical response, and sometimes that's the highest form of patriotism, is to be willing to be, as John Gardner once said, lovingly critical of your country and its institutions instead of either unlovingly critical or uncritically loving.
Dick Watts, we asked at the top of the hour, and it's flown away before we could get to it. Now you've got 30 seconds for the big one. Where does God's plan figure in here, in the religious perspective? You mentioned, when and if God were in charge, but how do tragedies like September 11th figure into a religious notion of events?
Well, certainly they wake us up to the fact that there is radical evil in the world, and they wake us up to the fact that there's much to be done to fashion the world after the divine intention. And all we know of the divine intention as Christians is that it's an intention for justice, it's an intention for human community, it's an intention for love. And so wherever we come from, our calling is to do whatever we can to advance that kind of agenda, no matter how dark the present situation may seem. So we're always oriented with hope towards the future and not just bogged down in the awful realities of the present.
Dick Watts, you were a great mentor years ago, and it's been a pleasure to have you on again tonight. Thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Reverend Richard G. Watts is co-author of Who is Jesus? Answers to Your Questions About the Historical Jesus. He spoke to us from Atlanta. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Tonight, we begin a five-part series featuring conversations with poet laureate Robert Pinsky about poetry in times of conflict. Each night, the former poet laureate will present poems written about the experience of wartime and the role these poems can play in the lives of the reader or the listener in interpreting the experience of conflict. Robert Pinsky.
I have one of the great war poems, Wilfred Owen's World War I poem, Dulce et Decorum Est.
Let's listen to that. Who reads it here?
Her name is Mary McWhirter. She's an accountant in Stockton, California. Mary can remember a teacher reading this poem in the classroom when she was in junior high school, and the other kids getting kind of giggly and finding the poem funny because the violence in it is so extreme. And she reminisces that she took the poem quite seriously because she knew what war was in the person of her father, who was blinded, indeed met her mother after he came back from the war, no longer having his sight. So here is Mary McWhirter reading Wilfred Owen's poem, Dulce et Decorum Est.
Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched to sleep. Many had lost their boots but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue. deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstripped 5-9s that drop behind. Gas, gas, quick boys. An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time, but someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams, you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cut of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori.
Dulce et decorum est, Wilfred Owen's poem. Robert Pinsky, we hang on these words, and we hang on your words. Help us to feel what she took from this poem to understand her own father's experience in World War II.
Well, you know, the oldest poetry of war, epic poetry of war, presents war as an individual matter. Beowulf, the heroes of Homer and the Iliad, even King David. War in that old epic context is an individual matter. It's one person testing strength and courage and luck against another. And for the overwhelming number of people, for millions and millions of people, war threatens individuality. It threatens to kill us, to maim us, to swallow us, to make our individual lives unimportant. And Mary McWhirter, through her own family and her own experience, had an experiential way of understanding what Owen was talking about in contrasting the heroic notion of war with his own experience of a fellow soldier who winds up gargling blood and writhing because a chemical got into his lungs before he could get his gas mask on in time.
There is so much poetry of war. How large a place in the overall universe of poetry does war and conflict play?
The art of poetry is ancient and takes for its medium, its means of expression, somebody's voice. I think it's appropriate that we heard Mary McWhirter read it rather than a poet or a skilled actor, because it's part of the meaning of poetry, in my opinion anyway, in the context of enormous events like terrorist attacks, battles, bombings. It's important to have an art that takes for its strength and its persistence and its importance one person's breath. Owen himself, Robert Graves, other people who wrote about the First World War, I think it's permanently part of what poetry means for us, is the individual voice. In a way, it's the most violent or extreme version of what I think is the importance of all sorts of poetry for us, not just war poetry, that it restores the idea that not a theater, not a technology, not even a trained artist's body, but anybody's voice is an important locale, the important enactor of a great art.
Robert Pinsky is a former U.S. Poet Laureate and the creator of the Favorite Poem Project. To read and listen to more poetry from the Favorite Poem Project run by Robert Pinsky, visit our website at wbur.org or go to favoritepoem.org. Tomorrow night, Robert Pinsky on Ralph Waldo Emerson, Bill Clinton, and the poetry of national identity. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is WBUR.